from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. The fatal police shooting of an unarmed black teenager in Ferguson, Missouri, has ignited outrage, protests, and raised questions about the value of heavily armed police officers. Police forces nationwide are increasingly using more firepower, military gear, and military tactics. We'll debate the militarization of law enforcement next on Forum after this. From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Mina Kim. Tensions appear to be subsiding in Ferguson, Missouri, after the fatal police shooting of unarmed black teen Michael Brown sparked angry protests earlier this week. But images of heavily armed police officers, at times dressed in camouflage and aiming sniper rifles at demonstrators, remain on people's minds. A June report by the American Civil Liberties Union finds local police forces around the country have been increasingly militarizing for years. We'll discuss that report and debate the merits of law enforcement agencies using military weapons and tactics in this hour of Forum. But first, we turn to Jeremy Kohler, an investigative reporter with the St. Louis Post-Dispatch, who has been covering the events in Ferguson, Missouri. Jeremy, thanks for being here.
Good morning.
And I understand the name of the officer who shot and killed Michael Brown was released this morning?
Yes, that's right. As you mentioned, it was a relatively peaceful night, but now things are really happening again. Ferguson Police Department has released the name of the officer as being Darren Wilson. And also released a timeline of events that led up to the shooting. One of the things that people are upset about is that apparently Mike Brown was a suspect in a robbery of a convenience store just before the shooting took place.
And why is that upsetting folks?
I think some people are upset about the timing of that of the release of that information this morning. And I believe that it's actually sparking more protests at the scene right now.
I see. So there were protests last night that were peaceful, but now protests seem to be starting up again.
Right. And I'm not at the scene right now. I'm in the newsroom, so I'm just going on basing this on what I hear my colleagues saying. But I think, I don't think there's any kind of violence at the scene right now, but I think there's quite a bit of activity.
Now, the Highway Patrol have taken over command of the operation. Have you seen a difference since then?
Right. Last night there was a marked tone in the policing. There was not the built-up, militarized presence that we had seen the previous nights, and there were a few small problems, but nothing major at all. And the scenes that you saw our photographers taking of tear gas canisters being thrown and officers with sniper rifles on these armored vehicles, that type of thing was not seen last night.
Right. President Obama did speak about what you described from earlier this week. He spoke about it yesterday. We have a clip of that I'd like to play.
I've already tasked the Department of Justice and the FBI to independently investigate the death of Michael Brown, along with local officials on the ground. The Department of Justice is also consulting with local authorities about ways that they can maintain public safety without restricting the right of peaceful protest and while avoiding unnecessary escalation.
Jeremy Kohler, are you hearing discussions on the ground about addressing the heavily armed police presence in the aftermath of the killing?
Yes. I think there was near universal condemnation of it the last couple of days, and I think last night was I think everybody was waiting to see what would happen. And, without the militarized presence on the ground there, the events were relatively peaceful. And this came after, of course, the Governor Nixon in Missouri took the command away from the St. Louis County Police Department and put it in the hands of the Missouri Highway Patrol, which is like the state police.
And, Jeremy, I'd like you to stay with us if you could a little bit longer. I'm going to introduce the guest that we have for the rest of the hour. Joining us is Rich Roberts. He's Public Information Officer for the International Union of Police Associations. Welcome, Rich Roberts.
Thank you.
And Kara Dansky, Senior Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union, Center for Justice, and author of the ACLU report, War at Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. Good morning to you, Kara Dansky. Kara Dansky? And I'm sure we'll get her in just a moment. Hi, Kara.
Hi. Sorry about that.
No, no problem. You know, just to lay the groundwork, if you would, could you define how your report defined police militarization?
Absolutely. We think that militarization has really three aspects, starting with a culture of militarism that we have seen evolving in American policing over the last several decades. We also think that militarization includes the tactics that the police are engaging in. We know, for example, that there are approximately 50,000 paramilitary raids every year in this country, which breaks down into roughly 124 paramilitary raids every day. So we view this as a militaristic tactic that the police are engaging in, for the most part, to conduct ordinary law enforcement activities. And we also think an aspect of the militarization of policing is the kinds of equipment that they're using. We saw that play out in Ferguson over the last several days.
And so how are state and local forces accessing these weapons?
Well, state and local police have virtually unlimited access to the U.S. military's arsenal through a program that is called the 1033 program. And this is a program that Congress established back in the 1990s, and it basically authorizes the U.S. Defense Department to make all of its arsenal available to local police departments. It also, I should say, authorizes the Defense Department to give preference to police departments that will use the military equipment to conduct counter-drug activities. We think that's particularly problematic because, as we know, the war on drugs has been fought relentlessly in communities of color for decades.
Jeremy Kohler, what do we know about Ferguson, Missouri's access to military equipment, the police force there?
Sure. Well, as I mentioned, it was really the St. Louis County Police Department that was running the show the last couple of nights. The Ferguson is a small municipality in the county, and they, from the early going, asked the county police department to come in and conduct not only the investigation into the shooting, but to secure the scene. And what you saw actually was SWAT units from multiple jurisdictions in the area. St. Louis County is a suburban county of a million people. You had SWAT units in from St. Charles County, which is another large suburban county. Interestingly, while the city of St. Louis, which is not part of St. Louis County, initially provided SWAT units to the security, the police chief in the city actually pulled them back the last couple nights because he said he didn't agree with the tactics that were being used.
And do you have a sense of when they began acquiring this equipment?
You know, from what I've read, it's really been in the last 10 to 15 years that they have been acquiring the equipment. But to tell you the truth, you know, I've been covering the police for a long time. You really don't see them in this equipment, using this equipment very often.
Jeremy, thanks so much. I know that you need to go. Thanks for joining us on Forum.
Thank you.
That's Jeremy Kohler, investigative reporter with the St. Louis Dispatch, St. Louis Post-Dispatch. Rich Roberts, you feel like access to this kind of military-grade equipment can be a good thing for both police and communities. Is that right?
In fact, that is right. The law enforcement is often underfunded and under-equipped, especially for critical incidents. Therefore, access to this kind of equipment is very important on two levels. One, to be able to ensure the public safety against major incidents, and two, to protect the officers themselves.
What's your reaction to some of the concerns that have been raised about the images that we saw coming out of Ferguson, Missouri, with, you know, police with sniper rifles trained on some demonstrators? Some commented that it looked more like a war zone than an American community.
Well, when storefront windows are being trashed, when looting takes place, you have to respond as fully and as quickly as you can.
And you feel like their response was appropriate?
Well, I can't comment on that specific incident because I'm not on the ground there. But I've been in this business for a long, long time, and I've seen many incidents of the same sort. The problem is control of the crowd. What happens is some perfectly innocent, well-meaning people hold a legitimate demonstration. As the crowds build, other people, and my understanding in this case, came from other areas and fomented much of the problem.
Carradine, sorry, go ahead.
The police have to respond.
Karadansky, what is your response to Rich Roberts' comments that police forces are, you know, under-resourced, ill-equipped, and they were dealing with folks who may have been looting stores, damaging buildings, vandalizing property, and also some protesters throwing Molotov cocktails at officers?
Sure, a couple things. You know, Chief Roberts referred to major incidents, and, you know, everybody agrees that it's absolutely critical for responders to have access to the equipment that they need when there's a life-threatening situation. One problem is that's not exactly what we're seeing, and that's not what we mean by militarization of law enforcement. We conducted an investigation into the militarization of law enforcement over the course of the last year and a half, and what we saw over and over again was the inappropriate and unnecessary use of paramilitary weapons and tactics, not to respond to major incidents, but rather to search people's homes, often for pretty small amounts of drugs. So the major incidents that Chief Roberts is referring to is really not what we're seeing on the ground. The other thing I would say is that the program that I referred to, the 1033 program, there's another provision of that program that allows DOD to transfer weapons that it has available to emergency responders. So it's not as though it's not as though if law enforcement didn't have access to military weaponry that it wouldn't be available for the purpose of responding to major incidents. I guess the other thing I would say in terms of Ferguson and what happened on the ground there is that I've spoken to a number of members of the law enforcement community, and what I hear from them is that what happened in Ferguson was a huge overreaction on the part of the police, and in fact, what the police's responsibility was there was to go in and de-escalate the situation. People were very upset about what had happened to Michael Brown, still are, and the police had a responsibility to go in and make sure that the people knew that the police were there to keep them safe. But that's not what happened, and that, in fact, when the police went in with an excessive and unnecessary military response, it served to escalate the situation, not de-escalate it.
And you highlight some examples of escalation in your report. Do you want to talk a little bit about the incidents that you documented?
You know, one of the most tragic incidents that we talk about in the report, and an important example of the pervasiveness of the militarization of law enforcement, is what happened in a small town outside Atlanta, Georgia, when the police decided to use a paramilitary SWAT team to raid a home, to search a home for a small amount of drugs. They did it in the middle of the night where this family was staying, and they threw what is referred to as a flashbang grenade into the house. It landed in the crib where a 19-year-old baby was sleeping, critically injuring him. He spent several weeks in the hospital. His parents didn't know whether he would survive. It was absolutely horrific. It's not the case that kind of tragedy results or those kinds of injuries result every time the police perform or conduct a paramilitary raid on a person's home. However, we do see this over and over again. What happened in the town outside Atlanta when Baby Boo Boo was injured is really one of tens of thousands of those kinds of raids that happen across America every year.
And you're saying that these raids are escalating because of the presence of these military, of this equipment that they're able to access and the tactics that they're trying to use.
Well, that was an example of a child being injured because of a paramilitary raid. I guess in terms of the escalation issue, we saw a number of incidents in which the police raided a person's home, again, often for small amounts of drugs. There's a case in Utah involving the police raiding the home of an Iraq veteran who was using marijuana for personal use for PTSD from having survived combat. And when they raided his home, he had a gun that he was lawfully, you know, permitted to have. And he didn't know that the people who were breaking down his door and storming into his home were police officers, and he shot several of them. So we see these kinds of tragic incidents result. We see the unnecessary use of paramilitary weapons and tactics escalating the risk of violence and putting people at risk on a regular basis.
Rich Roberts, what's your response to that, that the use of this type of equipment and military tactics can escalate a situation to the point where children and veterans can be hurt or killed?
In fact, the issue is not the weaponry as much as the tactics. This speaks then to the need for adequate analysis and adequate training. The weaponry is immaterial to these cases.
Do you agree?
Intelligence is the first critical thing you need. And perhaps in those cases, the officers did not have adequate intel. Too often, when you go into a critical incident, the information you have is going to be absolutely important to the tactic you choose.
Kara Dansky, do you think the weaponry is immaterial?
Well, I certainly think that training and intelligence are absolutely critical. No, I don't think that weaponry is immaterial. And, you know, I'm hearing from a lot of members of the military that they think that law enforcement use of this kind of equipment is completely inappropriate. I've heard a number of members of the military express astonishment that local law enforcement is using weapons that were built for combat. In many instances, the kinds of weapons that the police are using are more lethal and more violent than the kinds of weapons the military is using abroad.
And what rationale did the military give for saying that they thought it was inappropriate to you?
Because they understand that the unnecessary use of military equipment tends to escalate the risk of harm.
So what is the appropriate role, say, of a SWAT team, or, you know, in what situations should they be called in?
Well, certainly the kinds of major incidents that Chief Roberts mentioned earlier, this is the kind of incident that SWAT was created for back in the 1960s. Real serious emergency situations, active shooter situations, situations in which people are being held hostage, being barricaded, terrorist situations. You know, but these are in the minority. According to the investigation that we conducted, we examined 800 examples of paramilitary raids, and we found that of those 800, only 7% were for those kinds of emergency situations that SWAT was created for and that we think SWAT can sometimes be appropriate for.
So then, Kara Dansky, would you support the use of armored vehicles during active shooter situations?
You know, the problem with armored vehicles is that they escalate the situation and they make people feel as though they're on a battleground. And I think that the police need to be able to do what they need to do to de-escalate the situation. And what I hear over and over again from members of the law enforcement community and from people who have experienced paramilitary raids, that the use of an armored vehicle escalates the situation. It instills fear, it instills mistrust, and it is often it works at counter purposes to what the police are trying to accomplish.
We're discussing growing concerns over the military-style weapons and tactics showing up increasingly in state and local police forces with our guests, Rich Roberts, Public Information Officer for the International Union of Police Associations. He's joining us from Florida. And Kara Dansky, Senior Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union Center for Justice and author of the ACLU report, War at Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. She's joining us from D.C. Rich Roberts, how do you feel about armored vehicles? Do you feel like it's important for police to have them at their disposal?
Absolutely inappropriate situations. You have to clearly understand the standard police cruiser, a vehicle, car, four wheels, is not protection. The windows are vulnerable, and the body metal in a standard sedan will not stop firearms adequately. So in a situation where the unit anticipates hostile action with weapons, they have got to have protection. Same thing applies to body armor and helmets. While they do look military, of course, but it's important. One of the critical things an officer thinks about, I have to tell you this, and their families, the one thing they want to know is, at the end of a shift or an operation, are they going home or to the morgue?
What about to Kara Dansky's point that the situation becomes more hostile when there's the presence of armored vehicles and various other military equipment and tactics, that is actually what escalates the situation and can make it more harmful for officers' lives?
Actually, I consider that very much of an overstatement.
And why?
Simply because if the situation requires armored vehicles, or other military appearing equipment. If the situation requires it, they have to use it.
Garadansky, I wonder if do you feel like there is a middle ground here in terms of militarization? Are you completely against police having access to military-grade weapons and using paramilitary tactics?
Well, I mean, I think we need to back up and also get back to the question you asked at the outset, which is, what do we mean by militarization in the first place? And we don't just mean the equipment. We can definitely talk about the equipment, but...
No, I think it's been clear that, yes, in fact, this also includes tactics, right, and different ways of sort of using tenets of militarism in the military model.
Tactics and culture. You know, we saw throughout the course of our investigation a number of training materials, examples of training materials that are used to train police officers. And we saw an alarming number of incidents in which the police seemed to be receiving training to think of the people in the communities that they are supposed to be protecting and serving as enemies, to think of the neighborhoods that they're supposed to be protecting as battlefields, to think that what they do when they go into the field is akin to going into battle. And we see this view or this attitude, this culture, permeating law enforcement, and that's a big part of the problem. If they had access to unlimited military equipment but did not have the militaristic culture, would that be appropriate? You know, it's difficult for me to imagine that scenario, because having access to this kind of unlimited military arsenal is part and parcel with the militaristic culture that we've seen permeating law enforcement. I've spoken with a number of police officers who say that if you have the equipment, you're going to find a way to use it. And I think it's difficult to argue that when the police are dressed in what are called battle dress uniforms, they have equipment that they know has come back from Iraq or Afghanistan. They're told that they're soldiers fighting a war. It's difficult to conceive of a scenario in which they would have that kind of equipment and they would not adopt the military mindset.
And we'll continue our conversation about the use of military-style weapons by local police. How have the images of heavily armed police officers affected you? Are you concerned about the blurring distinction between police and the military? Or do you think it's important for our officers' public safety and the general public safety? Join the discussion. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can also email your questions or comments to forum@kqed.org, or you can post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. I'm Mina Kim. Stay with us. Welcome back to Forum. I'm Mina Kim. We're talking about the militarization of the police force. We're discussing concerns over the military-style weapons and tactics showing up increasingly in state and local police forces with our guests Rich Roberts, Public Information Officer for the International Union of Police Associations, and Garadansky, Senior Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union Center for Justice. She's also author of the ACLU report, War at Home, The Excessive Militarization of American Policing. Are you concerned about the blurring of the distinction between police and the military. Are you a police officer and feel you need these types of weapons and tactics with the situations that we're facing today? Join the discussion. Give us a call at 866-733-6786. That's 866-733-6786. You can always email your questions or comments as well to forum@kqed.org or post them on our website, kqed.org/forum. Rich Roberts, before we went to break, Kara Dansky was raising also the issue of trust and how these types of responses, when they're militaristic, can create distrust within the community. And what's your response to that? Because I know when I speak with law enforcement officers, they say that the law enforcement and the community working together is one of the most important aspects of public safety, of keeping the public safe.
All that has to be done long before an incident occurs. And one of the things, first of all, well, there are a couple of things here that are bothering me. The constant phrase, unlimited access, that does not exist. Number two.
Well, go ahead and explain that. How does unlimited access not exist?
No police department has unlimited access to anything. There are limits on everything a police department or a law enforcement agency deals with. So I think that's an exaggeration. But more importantly, is the brief mention of the word training. That is absolutely critical, and very few police organizations have adequate training budgets. We represent law enforcement officers all over the country. Now, it should be understood very clearly. We represent the working officer on the street, not command, not management. Our concern is for those men and women who are in harm's way. Therefore, training is critical at several levels. One, that the officer can make the right judgment calls, often in split seconds. And that requires good training, ongoing. A chief I worked under, who I had tremendous respect for, insisted on in-service training every chance he got. His statement was, your education does not end with academy graduation. It only begins. But that requires adequate budgets. Also, beyond that, the decision to go in occurs along with the incident. Relationships with the public has to start long before that. I remember the days when they were first using the phrase community policing. And I can tell you, good community policing, first of all, is a major asset. But also, it's something that any smart street cop had been using for his whole career before the phrase came up. Relationships with the community have to begin long before an incident occurs.
Rich Roberts, if you're concerned about the level of training that police officers are receiving, then should they have access to such, you know, military-grade weaponry if they aren't going to be adequately trained on them?
Well, they have to be trained.
Right, but you're saying that's not happening because of lack of resources, and I'm curious if you think...
Overall training. I'm not talking about military weapons per se. Much of the use of force is heavily dependent on judgment calls. The training has got to focus on making those kinds of judgment calls. But as I said, you can't sit around and debate what you're going to do. You don't have time. You have to know in advance how you're going to handle a given situation, and that requires extensive training.
And let's hear what our listeners have to say. Beth writes, our police departments are becoming more like military than peace officers, and I'm trying to figure out why more Americans are not concerned. This is where the Occupy Wall Street and Tea Party folks have got to agree. Nowhere in the U.S. Constitution does it encourage a police state, just the opposite. Not sure if it started happening after Homeland Security was created or not, but I know it sure has gotten worse. 9/11 and the Homeland Security was one of the federal programs that did start providing or funding this weaponry, correct, Kara Dansky?
Well, I think in terms of that, and in terms of the listener's question about why more people aren't concerned, you know, as we've been discussing, the police have been policing communities of color in a particularly aggressive and unnecessarily militarized fashion for many decades. So in many ways, what we're seeing on the ground in Ferguson, or what we saw over the last several days in Ferguson, is in many ways not a new problem. It's it's reflective of a problem that's existed for a very long time in terms of how many police departments, police communities of color, particularly in waging the war on drugs. But it wasn't well documented, and it hasn't been very well reported. So I agree with your listener that, that more people should be concerned. But in terms of why they aren't, I think that there hasn't been a lot of public awareness of this issue, and I'm encouraged that people are appalled by the militaristic response of the police in Ferguson. In terms specifically of 9/11 and DHS, you know, again, the militarization of policing has been going on for decades, starting in the 80s and 90s with the federal funding streams and the 1033 program that have really fueled the militarization of policing. So it predates 9/11, but I think it's true that when 9/11 happened and DHS was created, one consequence was an expansion of federal funding to unnecessarily militarize our police departments. So I think that it's a good point to note that, that the militarization of policing has expanded somewhat since 9/11. And I guess I would also want to address the listener's point about nonpartisanship. She didn't say it that way, but she mentioned the idea that, you know, folks on the right and the left should both be upset about this. I absolutely view this as a totally nonpartisan issue. This is about effective policing. I completely agree with what was said earlier about the importance of the police cultivating positive and healthy relationships with communities, and that's definitely not a partisan issue. So we think that there's plenty of room for folks on the right and on the left to get together to reform this problem.
And let's hear what our listeners have to say. Let's go to John in San Jose. Hi, John.
Hi. I just have I just wanted to share a story that an experience that I've had, and I'm glad that she's bringing up how the war on drugs ties to this. A couple years ago, my house was robbed, and three men with guns came in, and you know they beat up my friend, sent him to the hospital. We called the police. The police came. They found a small amount of personal use marijuana, which my friend had his marijuana card for. And all of a sudden, the investigation, they forgot about the assault. They stopped looking for those people, and it became about the drugs. And then they came with the SWAT team, kicked down all of our doors, and tried to make it look. And they were trying to make us like suspects. And after that, I don't call the police because I'm afraid that if they can't find what they're looking for, they're going to turn on us. And when you declare war on something, the police are going to start to act like soldiers, and and they're going to start to view the communities that they're supposed to be policing as occupied territory. That's what I wanted to share.
John, thanks for sharing your story. Let's go to Gary in Sacramento.
Hi, good morning. I just wanted to point out one simple fact in regards to the military vehicle. You know, if we send just plain officers into a hostile situation where those criminals may have, you know, some type of assault rifle or something of that nature, we can't expect these officers to protect the public with just standard sidearms and police vehicles that leave these officers in a bad situation. So there is a time and a place for these types of vehicles, and I do get that it does create that type of a hostile situation, but with the public. But it is a necessary evil.
Well, Gary, thanks for sharing your perspective. I'd like to take one more call. Let's go to James in Nevada City. Go ahead, James.
Yes, I'm looking at the ACLU report, War Comes Home, right in front of me on my table here. I'm flipping through it. I see an estimated 500 law enforcement agencies have received mine-resistant, ambush-protected vehicles built to withstand armor-piercing roadside bombs. Do we really need 500 of these vehicles and the maintenance required to keep them operating in our country to deal with mostly drug search warrant type stuff? This is ridiculous. We've turned into a police state, and people who don't realize that better smell the coffee or you'll get your door kicked down next.
Thanks, James. Rich Roberts, you know, James is clearly saying that he just doesn't think that there is any situation that would, you know, especially drug-related situations that would require armored vehicles. Do you have a response?
Again, it depends on the intelligence that the officers have going in, that the command has. We went on a raid, we had good intel, much of it indicated that the individual stored his drugs in his vehicle, not his home, and that the vehicle was booby-trapped. Our local officers went in with backup from the DEA. We had to borrow a bomb squad from a local military unit. They disarmed the vehicle. We captured the individual. We found drugs. And it was over. No shots fired. No one hurt. So those kinds of things can be done if carefully planned out because the teams were properly trained.
But in this case, you felt an armored vehicle was necessary?
We did not have an armored vehicle in our situation. However, it depends on the specific details of the upcoming operation, hoping you have adequate detail. If there is a suspicion that there will be excessive fire against the police, then they definitely need any armor they can get a hold of.
A listener writes, if police forces have acquired these military weapons for major incidents, then shouldn't we call in the National Guard in those incidents rather than militarize the police force? The state already has the military tools in military hands and can utilize them during major incidents. Why does the police force need them? Rich Roberts, I wonder, would it be more appropriate, given the issues that you've cited in local districts, right, that there is lack of funding and training and intel and so forth, that it would be better to put this in the hands of other trained forces?
That would be very dangerous to do because military units are not trained in domestic policing. They are purely trained in combat, and that's what they'd face. Police officers find themselves caught in a major bind between their desire to work with the community and their desire to protect themselves in critical incidents. And that's a very delicate balance.
Matt writes, the police expert made a dramatic comment about police ending a workday in the morgue. This kind of dramatized fear can justify any use of force. Why enter a suspect's house when you could burn it down or gas them out? Police must accept some risk or we can do without them. So, you know...
Wait a minute.
Well, I'm...
You are dead wrong on that score. Police must accept some risk or you could do without them?
Well,
I've never heard anything so ridiculous.
Well, Rich Roberts, it's a listener email, and I believe what the emailer is trying to say is if you said that police are always wondering whether they'll end the workday in the morgue, you could use that as a rationale to arm up beyond what may be necessary, I think was the main point of the email. Like, where can you draw the line?
All right, there's an excessive focus on the physical equipment, and the differences are basically, from any other equipment, are basically cosmetic. I did a very careful review for a given department regarding the use of patrol rifles as traditionally for years. The squad car carried a 12-gauge pump shotgun in a rack against the dashboard. The officers themselves found, and we did the research, that a patrol rifle in the vehicle actually was a major advantage in terms of protecting people in the area, not just the officer. And because the rifle's much more precise, you can pick your target very, very carefully, far more so than you can with a shotgun. So the concern was, the one thing police officers cannot afford that the military is used to, and that's called collateral damage. If you do not use the equipment the way it needs to be used, or you don't have adequate equipment, you have a higher risk of collateral damage, and it is unacceptable in police work.
And we're discussing growing concerns over military-style weapons and tactics in state and local police forces with our guests Rich Roberts, Public Information Officer for the International Union of Police Associations, and Kara Dansky, Senior Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union Center for Justice. Kara Dansky, in your report, did you see different parts of the country where more forces were accessing these weapons and using these tactics than others?
You know, there are tens of thousands of law enforcement agencies across the country, and we examined some incident reports of paramilitary raids from a tiny sliver. You know, one of the issues that we discuss in our report is the real lack of data on the use of paramilitary weapons and tactics by law enforcement because the police are not required to report on their use of paramilitary weapons and tactics. I say all of that to say that we were not able to conduct a comprehensive review of all of the uses of paramilitary weapons and tactics across the country. That would be incredibly daunting because the data is so difficult to come by. The police departments are not required to report on it. There's no central repository of data on this. So we think that that's a huge part of the problem, and we're calling on state and local governments to be more transparent in their use of paramilitary weapons and tactics. Until that happens, it's really difficult to say. It's very difficult to answer your specific question, which has to do with variation across the country. Certainly, police departments are very varied in terms of their structure, their culture, their training. There's a tremendous amount of variation out there. Police departments are virtually autonomous in terms of how they function, and that may not be a bad thing. I'm not necessarily complaining about that. I'm just saying there's a lot of variation out there, and it's very difficult to make the kinds of comparisons that you're asking that be made in the absence of real data to be able to examine the situation.
And that's one of the recommendations of your report in terms of trying to increase public oversight.
Exactly. We think that oversight and accountability is absolutely critical so that we can prevent the kinds of injuries that we've seen. You know, we also think that the police have a right to know, the people have a right to know how they're being policed. If the police are truly using paramilitary weapons and tactics in extreme major incidents where that level of force is truly warranted, then there should be no problem in providing the data and the information to demonstrate that.
And Rich Roberts, do you agree that, you know, at least there should be more accounting and requirement of police forces to account for all the military weaponry and also the types of tactics that they're using, the incidents involving these tactics as well?
We maintain a legal unit within the International Union, and we retain lawyers around the country because every use of force incident or an officer-involved shooting will be scrutinized deeply and closely to make sure that the activities met with the standards that had been established under law, not by the department per se. Police officers have to follow law just like anyone else, and we are often more restricted in our actions than the general citizenry. I also find it very interesting that the discussion came up on a lack of data, and yet decisions are being made, facts are being thrown out with the admission of a lack of data. And as far as the number of people out there, there are only... But there are actually less than 100,000 sworn law enforcement officers in the entire United States. That's not a very big population. So I don't see where they're having that big a problem with data.
Gary Dansky, do you want to respond? I mean, you're referring to the incidents as well, not just the number of officers.
Well, that's right. I mean, I referred to the number of law enforcement agencies that are out there and the number of incidents. I guess my point about oversight was not so much that we want to necessarily protect the police from scrutiny. We shouldn't have oversight so that we can ensure that the police have adequate legal protection. It was really more about community police relationships and the public's right to know what the police are doing in their communities. So I just wanted to make that clear in terms of what I meant by oversight and accountability.
And let's go to more of your calls. Let's go to Kevin in Daly City. Hi, Kevin.
Hi.
Hi. Go ahead, please.
I actually just wanted to comment both as an Afghanistan veteran and as a former sheriff volunteer. When I was in high school, I was a sheriff explorer in Spokane, Washington. We had a great program. We did a lot of ride-alongs. We got really great training. In fact, you know, I did an emergency vehicle operators course. I was certified to check out actual police cruisers for events and things like that. When I was growing up, I never had a bad experience with the police. You know, I felt the police were there to help me to, you know, basically be police, you know, enforce laws and keep order. And later on, I went on to Afghanistan as an MRAP field service representative for Mantech International. I worked on cougars mainly, some RGs and stuff like that. I just kind of wanted to comment that I think it's absolutely ridiculous that police are getting MRAPs. You know, it's not a vehicle that anyone needs outside of a very specific situation. That situation is running over Soviet mines.
Kevin, thanks very much for your comment. I appreciate that. Let's go to Jesse in San Francisco. Go ahead, Jesse.
Hello. Yeah, I just wanted to say that I'm listening to both sides of the story, and it's really interesting because there is one issue, and I think that is basically under training. They're definitely outnumbered, and I think both sides are agreeing to the fact that officers are very outnumbered right now. And I think if I was to put myself in a situation and think of myself as an officer, which lived in your everyday neighborhood, and many times our neighbors are friends, and these guys are putting themselves out, and they are in these hostile situations every now and then, and I can just imagine how afraid they must be in some circumstances, because their job is to serve and protect, and they're out there putting themselves on the line, and in a lot of ways they are undertrained, and they do have this equipment that maybe they shouldn't have or be using, but there's this underlying fear I can just picture in their minds when they see hostile crowds.
Jesse, thanks. I appreciate your point. You know, Kara Dansky, I wonder what Jesse's talking about in terms of training and what we've talked earlier about in terms of establishing trust. It points to the fact that the issue of militarization of police is much bigger than just the officers in the unit themselves. It's more of a systemic issue that you're trying to address. Is that right?
I think that's right, and I don't think there's any disagreement at all that officers need to be adequately trained. I think we all agree on that point. And it's not about any individual officers. We really do think that this is much more of a cultural issue in terms of how the police generally see themselves with respect to the communities that they're supposed to be protecting and serving. We've seen increasingly over the last several decades a shift in how the police think about themselves with respect to those communities. And we've seen, you know, we're talking about training here. You know, we've actually seen training materials that show that the police are being trained to think of the neighborhoods that they're supposed to be serving as war zones. And we don't think that that's appropriate. I definitely think that the police need adequate training. I hear that. And I think it's important both for officer safety and for public safety that officers receive the training that they need. And I think that that needs to be appropriate training. I don't think that that should be training that tells officers that they should be thinking about the people that they're supposed to be protecting and serving as wartime enemies.
John writes, a good number of police forces throughout the nation have a military background, so the military gear is for the most part familiar. Two, the mind of the police when in uniform is akin to preparing for war. Be safe and make sure you go home to your loved ones. And I'm being told that John is a police officer. Three, John writes, training in my experience amounts to signing a roster sheet whereby the department receives credit for keeping its force trained. I am recently retired after 26 years on the force. We have a proportional number of bad apples as there are in society. Rich Roberts, do you have a response to that?
Actually, there's something more important here, although I agree that, yeah, training is absolutely critical, and quite frankly, most of the academy training that I've observed, and that's quite a bit, does focus on community policing. And special teams, like SWAT, do have to have sufficient skills to handle critical incidents. So, again, there's a very, very fine line.
But again, Rich Roberts, I go back to my question that if the training is inadequate, I'm just curious if you think it's appropriate for police officers to have access to such weapons and tactics.
Yeah, it's absolutely appropriate according to a case-by-case basis. The incident, the characteristics of the incident determine the kinds of weapons and equipment that are needed to handle the incident.
David in San Francisco, let's go to you. Hi, David.
Yeah, how are you? There's a famous old expression, I forgot who said it, turn your swords to plowshares. And if you think about, say, 1990, when George Bush the First won the Gulf War in 37 days or whatever, he forgot to bring all those weapons back. We sent tonnage over there for months, and then they forgot to bring them back. And so now when we're over in Iraq and Afghanistan and whatnot, we're fighting our own weapons that we left there. Now that we've backed out of Afghanistan and we're supposed to be backing out of Iraq, we're not bringing what we are bringing back is ending up in our police forces, and what we're leaving over there is ending up in the forces of ISIS. So the issue is turning the swords to plowshares.
David, thanks for your comment. We've got a lot more, and we're running short on time. A listener writes, the issue is not police tactics. The issue is police attitudes. Too many police departments act like occupying forces. They don't live in the communities they serve, and they rarely walk the streets and get to know their communities. Police should learn from the military effort to win hearts and minds in Afghanistan and Iraq. Community policing is the key to long-term violence prevention. Mike writes, one of your guests said that the problem is not the military-style weapons, it's that the officers are not properly trained to use them. No, that is not the issue. Proper training the officers to use military-style weapons produces a domestic military. We don't want or need a domestic military. And we were joined, that brings us to the end of our show. We were joined this hour by Rich Roberts, Public Information Officer for the International Union of Police Associations, and Kara Dansky, Senior Counsel with the American Civil Liberties Union. I just want to ask you both for just one quick concluding comment. Rich Roberts?
The best thing a department can do, and many have, is establish what are called Citizens Academy. A truncated version of the actual police academy that any citizen can volunteer to attend. Therefore, the citizens learn far more about police work than they had ever known before.
And Kara Dansky.
What we saw happen in Ferguson over the last several days is reflective of a much broader trend of the militarization of policing, which has been going on for decades, particularly in communities of color. But there are solutions. We're calling on governments at all levels to work to restrain the inappropriate use of paramilitary weapons and tactics.
And Kara Dansky, Rich Roberts, I thank you both. I also want to thank Jeremy Kohler from the St. Louis Post-Dispatch. I'm Mina Kim. Thanks so much for listening.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation, and by a generous gift from Jan Schremm and Maria Minetti Schremm, founders of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.